Hello, you are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. My name is Andrew Popel, and the show you are listening to is Final Draft. It is books, writing, and literary culture. Every week, I do a stack of reading, which is something that I absolutely love, but I also get to speak to the authors that create the books that we love, and I bring those conversations to you here on the radio. Today, I have a fantastic new book. It is from Kate Grenville. But before we get to that, I'd like to acknowledge that 2SER broadcasts from the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. Now, I'm recording this show from home, and I'm on the lands of the Darug and the Gundungurra people. I want to acknowledge the traditional owners. I want to acknowledge their ongoing connection with that land. Sovereignty was never ceded and always was, always will be Aboriginal land. Now, today on the show, I have a new novel from Kate Grenville. It is her first novel in about 10 years. Kate is the author of The Secret River, which so many people know. A Roommate of Leaves is her latest, and it goes back and explores territory that she does cover in The Secret River. It looks at Elizabeth MacArthur, who was the wife of John MacArthur, and explores the idea that what if there was a secret diary, a secret journal that she had written, a memoir of her time that sort of told all of that early period of invasion and settlement. So that is Kate Grenville's latest novel. I'm going to be speaking with Kate over the phone. So I'm excited to be bringing this to you. Kate is a fantastic writer, and it is always a pleasure to have a new book from her. You are listening to Final Draft on 2SER 107.3. That interview with Kate Grenville is coming up after this short break.
2SER wishes to acknowledge the custodians of the land from which we broadcast, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and the Wadumatagal clan of the Darug Nation, and their elders past, present and emerging. We acknowledge and respect their continuing culture and the contribution they make to the life of this city and this region.
You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3, and this is Final Draft. My name is Andrew Popel, and I have an absolutely thrilling guest to share with you. Kate Grenville is the award-winning author of novels such as The Idea of Perfection and The Secret River. She has a new book out. It is called A Room Made of Leaves, and it's her first novel in about a decade. So it's absolutely fantastic to have her on the phone. We are practicing social distancing, aren't we, Kate? Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's really lovely to be with you.
It is really exciting to be chatting again, and about a very different topic. Of course, the last time we spoke, it was your non-fiction book about the case against fragrance, and these are very different beasts. I'd like, if I could, just to introduce people to A Room Made of Leaves. So Elizabeth MacArthur arrived in New South Wales aboard the convict ship Scarborough in 1790. The 24-year-old gentlewoman had arrived with her husband, an officer in the New South Wales Corps, and she would live in New South Wales until her death in 1850, playing a key role in establishing the wool industry that would occupy so much of early Australia. Much of what we know of Elizabeth MacArthur comes from her letters to family in England. But what if there was more? A Room Made of Leaves opens up the possibility that Elizabeth MacArthur wrote a frank and potentially scandalous memoir of her early life. Freed by death, distance and time, this Elizabeth is able to reflect on her life and the folly and cruelties of the English invasion of what would come to be known as Australia. Okay, this is a fantastic conceit, and about a third into the book you have Elizabeth. She's arrived in Sydney and she's composing letters home, and she complains that they are full of fancy phrases but empty of content. She's complaining, of course, that her words must be acceptable, not just for her family at home, but for the censorious gaze of her husband, whose name I haven't mentioned yet because I don't really want to center him too much in the narrative yet. But her husband's going to read those letters before they were sent. So I want to begin with this unrestrained Elizabeth that you open up for us. Why is it important for us to imagine the inner mind of a woman such as Elizabeth?
Look, our picture of women of the past is a very distorted one because they were so heavily sort of laced around by the restrictions of their society and their time. So all their letters were, in fact, public documents. They would be read aloud very often in the family parlour and shared with neighbours. If they wrote novels, they had to be kind of respectable. But the nearest they could come to saying what they might really think would be some of the novels of Jane Austen, where you hear in the irony, the kind of savage irony, you hear a hint of something else. But really there was no way in which they could leave a written record of what they really thought about lives that must have been, well, we would regard them, women today would regard those lives as hell, basically. Being married to a man that often you'd barely met, having to marry because there was simply no other way to, you know, make a living, basically, and no divorce. So you were stuck with him. I mean, it'd be like, you know, imagine your very first boyfriend. Imagine you'd had to marry him and then had 8 children with him. That would be the kind of thing that had to happen. And of course, there was no way of testing in advance whether what you did in bed together was going to be pleasurable to either or both of you. So their lives must have been absolute hell without any possibility of escape. Now, all we have of them are these, as in the case of Elizabeth MacArthur, these very bland letters. And if you took those letters at face value, you would think that they were perfectly happy and very pious and, you know, devoted wives and so on. But I can't believe that they were that different from us. And that's what made me think, well, you know, it didn't happen, but what if one of them, namely Elizabeth MacArthur, wrote a secret private memoir and hid it away so that it was found 200 years later, and for once, at last, finally, we can hear what one of those women really thought. Now, of course, the book is fiction, so who knows whether any of those women really thought that. My own strong belief is that they would have. And so I feel as if I've given a voice to those, all those silenced women in the representative person of Elizabeth MacArthur.
And there is precedent to what you're suggesting here, perhaps not in the in any evidence we have of the inner minds of women, but of course in from the early invasion and the early settlement, there were fabulously positive letters and reports going home to England of the fecundity of the colony that was being established, which of course Elizabeth would have found was not the case. Can you give us a little bit of an idea of this biography of Elizabeth that we are reading in A Room Made of Leaves?
Yes, it starts with her saying, you know, I'm writing this memoir and how fabulous that I've outlived my husband, who was one of the more difficult parts of her life, and that she's finally, he's dead and at last I'm free to speak. So she tells the story really of her life from childhood in Devon in England, the daughter of a farmer, to sort of the climax of her life in Australia, not the end of it, but the point at which her life was kind of settled when her husband sailed off to England. He'd just had a duel with his commanding officer, that was the kind of man he was, and had to go back to England to kind of defend himself. So she was then left alone in Australia, minding the enormous family property and all the sheep business on it, and made a huge success of it. And that's why we remember her. It's why Elizabeth MacArthur, at least for people of my generation, is a kind of known person, not exactly famous, partly because sheep, for most of us, I have to say, at least until I've researched this book, sheep are not that interesting. So someone who's famous for having kind of bred them is, not going to set the heart racing. But in fact, of course, her story, I think, was extremely interesting. I don't want to be a spoiler, but, you know, it's very likely, I think, or certainly in my memoir, she has a tumultuous love affair, which gives her some satisfaction in a life which otherwise didn't have much emotional satisfaction.
Through her writing, your Elizabeth comes to celebrate and also lament the discovery of what she calls my own true voice. Now, there are quite a few layers to peel back here, but I think it's worth it for what you have to say about the authority that we give to voices, and particularly those that survive from this period of colonial invasion. So given the paucity of historical voices from women, and also, and most particularly from Gadigal, Darug and Darawal people, how do you think we should go about reading the historical voices that are available to us?
You know, when I was reading Elizabeth MacArthur's letters, I was struck by the fact that a lot of them were what they call cross-written. In order to save paper, because you paid postage by the number of pages of paper you used, they would write in one direction and then they would turn the page at right angles and write another line crossing over the first. And I think that's a really good metaphor for how we have to read all those documents of the past. I mean, it's what good historians do. They say, look, here's the document, here's what it says, but a good historian will ask, who wrote this? What was their agenda? Who was their audience? Why were they writing it? And, of course, how much did they know? So, of course, a lot of our knowledge of the all the Indigenous people all over Australia, actually, comes from the white man's record. Well, I say white man's, white people's, but mostly white man's record. That has to be taken with a huge pinch of salt. Those people were looking at events unfolding, and those white people saw them through their own eyes. So they're imposing their interpretation and, of course, what suits them to say. So we have to always unpick them. You know, this book is dedicated to all those whose stories have been silenced. And one of those sets, of course, is women, but the other is the Indigenous people in Australia. Because the stories that have come down about them have to be read a bit like a Jane Austen novel, as if they are ironic. We have to look behind the words to see, to even begin to glimpse the truth that might actually be there.
You offer us, I guess, something of an antidote to this grasping for certainty, this need to understand a history, in the words of William Dawes. So William Dawes became Elizabeth's astronomy teacher in Sydney. And at one point in the book, he says to her, "We decide what we think we know from such evidence as we have. In the absence of more evidence, we can do no other. But we must be humble." I'm going to say that line again because I love it so much. "We must be humble. You know to question the evidence and know it to be partial, most particularly to be humble about the conclusions we draw, not to be too sure." Now, Kate, I feel like we see a continual failure to be humble in our leaders. Would you perhaps prescribe this as an enduring malady of the white invasion and settlement?
Look, I think perhaps, well, yes, but I think also it's probably a human, more broadly, it's a human compulsion to invent a story about something and then to kind of hang on to it as if you are sure that it's right. You know, Daniel Kahneman, who's written a lot about sort of the psychology of storytelling, calls a story a machine for jumping to conclusions. And that is, I think, a fabulous way of putting it. So, you have to make a story because you have to somehow make it coherent. But the only way of making a story that's sort of a satisfying narrative is to actually leave a lot out and very often to falsify, which is why the story of science and sometimes the story of history is not as gripping as a narrative as it might be, because they've been honest enough to put in all those loose ends and repetitions and contradictions that slow a story down. You know, a novelist doesn't do that, and we're kind of allowed to do that, I think. So we have to be, you know, that little bit that you just read out, that's very perceptive of you, because some famous person said every novel is written to conceal one sentence within it. And this book wasn't written to conceal that sentence, but what you just read out is the heart of it. We have to be humble. We have to admit when we don't know, and we have to be always prepared to say, this is the best decision we can make on the basis of what we know, and we have to be very open to changing our minds, making another machine to jump to a different set of conclusions.
That is Kate Grenville there, offering some insights into novelistic art. My name is Andrew Popel, and you are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. This is Final Draft. It is books, writing, and literary culture. The book that I am in conversation with Kate about is A Room Made of Leaves. It's Kate's first novel in about 10 years. And look, I have got more of that conversation to share with you. But as always, I want to share some local music because it's still hard. Like, gigs are maybe going to start up soon, but we still have to support local musicians and local arts. So this is from Sydney band The Electorate. It is called Enormous Glorious Girl.
Interested in a career in music? Be it at the front of a stage or managing the show out back, Get Gig Ready has you covered. Monday nights on 2SER, we're going to be sitting down with some amazing local talent to get you prepared for the music industry. This week, it's rapper and drummer Dobby, and we'll be speaking about his music, his community outreach, and how to use music to advocate for what matters to you.
Yo, what up, everyone? This is Dobby, and you can catch me this week on Get Gig Ready.
Monday nights, 6:30 p.m. on 2SER 107.3.
You are tuned into 2SER 107.3. Just there we heard from Sydney band The Electorate. The track we heard was Enormous Glorious Girl. If you want to keep supporting local artists, you can go to The Electorate's Bandcamp and you can get that track. You can support any of the artists that you hear on 2SER, around the world, but also so important to support local artists. Now, today on the show, I am in conversation with Kate Grenville. Kate Grenville is the author of The Secret River, but today she is discussing her new book. It is called A Room Made of Leaves. It's her first novel in about 10 years. So let's get back to that conversation with Kate Grenville. But look, I want to come back to your Elizabeth, because through her astronomy lessons with William Dawes, your Elizabeth meets members of the Gadigal people and she learns some of their language. She also comes to suspect the prevailing wisdom that they are supposedly not worthy stewards of their own land. Now, I imagine that this was difficult ground for you to tread, because, of course, you cannot turn Elizabeth into a white saviour in this story. But what did you want to grow out of these interactions between Elizabeth and the different Indigenous peoples that she met?
Look, you're right, it was difficult. It's why the book took me 20 years. I started researching this when I was, I came across Elizabeth MacArthur when I was researching The Secret River, so that's 20 years ago. So that's why, it's one of the many reasons why this was a book that took me 20 years to write. What I began to realise is that, in The Secret River, I told a story about a person, a first contact story between a white person taking land that had belonged to the Indigenous people. And I thought, that's an important story to tell, and I'm glad I've told that. But there's another aspect to it, which is, what is the story that that person then tells? What are the stories that have come down to us? And how true are they, basically? They're all seen only through one set of eyes, that is the white people's eyes. So let's take them apart a bit. And knowing, as I did, that the real Elizabeth MacArthur did in fact have quite a bit of interaction with the Sydney Indigenous people, partly via Mr. Dawes, but I think partly on her own. There's a lovely scene in one of her letters, one of the few interesting bits, where she describes an Aboriginal woman called Duringa coming into her house and showing her baby, who's wrapped up in paper bark. And Elizabeth MacArthur's tone in that is wonderfully tender and affectionate. And she lists some lovely Aboriginal names to whoever she's writing to and says, listen to how beautiful these are. So there was connection there with the Indigenous people, and at least some degree, at least at some of her life, in some times of her life, some degree of kind of sympathetic softness. So that gave me a way then to say, well, this is a person who might well have heard some of the stories about the Indigenous people and would be in a position to question them because she's actually known them. You know, she says, for example, that her husband tells her what was a bit of scuttlebutt in the early colony, that the Aboriginal people ate their own babies. It's so horrendous, I can barely actually make myself say it. In that scene where Duringa comes into her hut and shows her baby with such absolute love and, devotion to the child, she thinks, well, I've heard that story and it's getting repeated around the colony. One person is telling another, and like Chinese whispers, it's growing. But what I'm seeing in my own experience is something totally different. So what that makes me realise is you can't trust those stories. They are told because they benefit the people telling it, basically. And I'm now going to start questioning those stories because I can see that they're not true.
And in learning the language, Elizabeth also has a transformation of the way she views the colony and then the botany, the trees, the plants around her, they had been given names that kind of transplanted Englishness onto, you know, trees that could never hold the title. But as she learns new names, she learns new ways to look. And through that, you also show us some of the impressions of the land as being perceived as harsh and unlivable because these very English crops were initially failing to thrive. And I was recalled to a poem by Gomeroi poet Alison Whittaker. It's called A Love Like Dorothea's, where she reflects on Dorothea McKellar's almost sort of fetishizing of the harshness of the so-called sunburnt country. And it's a country that Whittaker can no longer call her own because her people had been displaced. It feels, particularly in the wreckage of the recent bushfires, that we still haven't overcome a lot of this ignorance about the land that Elizabeth was encountering, and most particularly John MacArthur was encountering as he was vying for land holdings.
Yes, I think the British have always had a problem. I think they still do have a problem with the Australian landscape. I mean, a lot of us have probably known British people. You're driving along a beautiful bit of English countryside, and the British person will say, "Oh, it's all the same, isn't it? It's all the same. It's so ugly." One of the things I've shown in the book is the growth in Elizabeth MacArthur from that feeling, which is fairly natural when you go to a completely strange landscape. It's very foreign. It's not what you expect, and so you tend not to see what's valuable about it. But one of the things I wanted to show in the book was how somebody gradually learns how to see a new place. And once you've seen it, it's very hard not to love it. Mm. So William Dawes teaches her a bit of botany as well as introducing her to some of the Indigenous people. And it's through that different perspective that she herself comes to realise that she realises she loves the place. It's actually home. She doesn't want to go back. And of course, this is towards the end of the book where she's thinking to herself, well, that's the fact of the matter. This is now home. I've had my children. I've buried one or two of them here. I don't want to go back. But on the other hand, this is not my place. She says, you know, I'm prepared to admit I am a thief. And the worst of it is I can acknowledge that without being prepared to get on a boat and go back to England. And it's not quite where a white person like me is, but it's not that far from it. It's like we have to work out a way of being here on stolen land, and it's very tricky to do. It's very tricky territory to negotiate.
It struck me, and I really liked what you said about Elizabeth coming to see the land in a new way, because it is something that I think we all need to do, and you make a really important point there that it is very difficult as white Australians right now to ever conceive of the idea that we could just get back on boats and go home as some way of reparation for, you know, centuries of stolen land and stolen so many things stolen. But we the consequence of that is, though, that we then need to find a way to make reparation in another way and to listen. And I think a little bit of you've presented a conundrum that you also beautifully illustrate in A Room Made of Leaves, because of course through John MacArthur we can see that it is very difficult to tell an ignorant man that he is ignorant and expect him to do anything useful with that information. And in William Dawes, of course, reminding us of this need to be humble, the people that need to be humble are never the ones that are going to listen to that message.
That's so true. Yes. Almost by definition, the ones who need humility don't even recognise the word, in a way. Humility doesn't make a lot of progress, I think, in any world, probably. I mean, Dawes was a terrifically progressive man. He was an abolitionist, you know, way back in the very early days of trying to fight slavery. And after Australia, he spent his life trying to help ex-slaves in Liberia and then ex-slaves and slaves in the West Indies. So, you know, he was a good man. But he died poor. left no real sort of mark on things, didn't change anything, I suppose you could say. And maybe that's the human reality. The bullies often win. The bullies like John MacArthur often are the ones who win. Although, I have to say, in a room made of leaves, he actually doesn't.
I'm speaking with Kate Grenville. Her latest novel is A Room Made of Leaves, promising an untold story of Elizabeth MacArthur. Kate, there is so much more to speak about, but I want to say thank you for taking the time to chat with me.
Thank you, Andrew. It's been such good fun. Thanks.
Stories. Ideas. Music. 2SER 107.3.
That's right, you are on 2SER 107.3. My name is Andrew Popel, and you have been listening to Final Draft. Now, I've got to go in a minute or two. Before I do, though, I want to say thank you to Kate Grenville. Kate came on the show today and was discussing her new novel, A Room Made of Leaves. If you missed any of that conversation, look, it will be going up online on 2SER.com /Final Draft, but also, most importantly, it'll be up on the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast. Now, if you've not listened into the podcast before, but you do enjoy the show, you will catch a whole lot more that actually doesn't always make it to air. Sometimes these discussions, you know what it's like. You know what it's like when you start talking books. It can go for, I've had some great conversations, and I will be featuring some extra bits that didn't make it to air in that conversation with Kate. If you are looking for more books as well, can I remind you that 9 p.m. on Sunday night and replayed on Thursdays at 7:30 p.m. is Death of the Reader. You can join Flex and Herds as they take you through some of the great mysteries of the world. And that would be mystery novels. last week on Final Draft, we featured the latest from Solari Gentile. And Flex and Herds are actually going to be going back to Solari Gentile's All the Tears in China and taking you through episode by episode that fantastic novel. So tune in on Sunday night for Flex and Herds and Death of the Reader. My name is Andrew Popel. It's almost time for me to leave. Look, thank you so much. It's been absolutely great joining you. There are some fantastic novels, some fantastic anthologies coming up, including After Australia, which features writers of colour and Indigenous authors exploring a post sort of white Australia, and Robbie Arnott's new book. Robbie Arnott's the author of Flames, his new book, The Rain Heron. My name is Andrew Popel. It's time for me to say goodbye, and till next week, happy reading. Bye now.